This is edition number 2016 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 8th of May 2026. Hello and a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper. Just one item from the notice board this week. The sun rises at around 5 o'clock in the morning and sets at around 8:30 in the evening. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 7th of May. I am Judith Elliott-Hunter and my fellow readers are...
Claire Hill.
Sue Hill.
Jane Bradbury.
The magazine supplement, which includes A Norfolk River, Our Local Superheroes, Saving the Curlew, and Why Mike Was Grateful, follows later. But first, a deadly start to the year on county roads sparked safety warnings for bikers. Dad left in the dark about his cancer treatment as staff went on holiday. I love you, 11-year-old boy's final words to his mother before he died from cancer. However, we lead with hotelier in row with chef and former owner of Michelin-starred restaurant. It is one of Norfolk's few Michelin-starred restaurants, known for its famous former chef patron, Galton Blakiston. But Mawston Hall's new owner, Henry Elworthy, now claims an extraordinary row between him and the high-profile chef has left a bitter taste in the mouths of both men. The hotelier bought the hotel and restaurant near Blakeney from Mr. Blakiston in April last year. From the outside, it appeared to be a smooth transition, with Mr. Blakiston selling the business to Mr. Elworthy and continuing to work in the kitchen as the restaurant's executive chef. But Mr. Elworthy now alleges that a falling out between them culminated in the chef leaving the restaurant in November. The hotel and real estate investor believes the chef lost interest after selling the business, which he claims led to a decline in the quality of the food coming out of the kitchen and a drop in bookings. Internal data seen by this newspaper indicated a spike in Google and TripAdvisor reviews of 3-star or lower between April, when Mr. Blakiston sold Mawston Hall, and early November, when he left the kitchen. One 1-star TripAdvisor review, left in June, said it was as far away from being a Michelin-starred experience as it was possible to be. A 3-star review said that, while the food was exceptional, the service didn't match. However, there were still several 5-star reviews, while Mr. Blakiston remained in the kitchen, describing both the food and service as impeccable and worthy of a Michelin star. Mr. Elworthy said relations between the pair soured after the sale went through, which led to a simmering row. I agreed with Galton for him to stay on as executive chef after I bought it, he claimed. But when I bought the business from him, he just lost interest. Our public reviews last summer were just awful. Galton was driving the kitchen downwards. It was like having a child in the kitchen. We ended up parting ways in early November. Mr. Blakiston, who also owns the award-winning number one fish and chip shop in Cromer, was approached for comment on Mr. Elworthy's allegations, but declined to respond. Mr. Blakiston co-owned and ran Mawston Hall with his now ex-wife, Tracy Blakiston, for 34 years, since 1992. During that time, the restaurant held a coveted Michelin star for 27 years and was awarded 4 AA rosettes. However, Mr. Elworthy claimed that the hotel and restaurant was struggling financially when he bought the business last April. He claimed its revenue had dropped by 20% between January and April 2025. Mr. Blakiston was asked about this allegation but declined to comment. Another of Mr. Elworthy's allegations was that the renowned chef didn't want the business to survive without him. If he couldn't have it, no one could, he said. The hotelier claimed that in the weeks before he took over, the former couple changed the contracts of Mawston Hall's front of house staff, moving them from a 5-day working week to 4. They were all on full-time contracts, working 44 hours a week across 5 days, and they got switched to 45 hours across 4 days, he said. they used to work 4 p.m. until midnight 5 days a week. And that was quite an efficient use of time because guests would arrive late afternoon for dinner. You could have your morning team start at 7 a.m. and leave at 4 p.m. On a 4-day week, my morning team were coming in at 7 a.m. and finishing at 6 p.m., which is silly because my evening team would come in at 1 p.m. and finish at midnight to use up their hours. I was paying two teams from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. when there were no guests in the hotel. By putting everyone on a 4-day week, they essentially increased my front-of-house payroll by 20% because I had to cover an extra day with overtime, which staff are happy to work because it's more money. There was no commercial reason to do it. It was killing the business, as restaurants have a low margin and their biggest cost is payroll. I moved staff back to a 5-day week in December. Mr. Blackiston was asked whether he changed the front-of-house contracts before selling the business to Mr. Elworthy, but declined to comment. Tracy Blackiston was also approached for comment several times, but has not responded. Mawston Hall currently employs 30 members of staff and appointed Phil Kersey as executive chef in December last year.
Motorcyclists are being urged to refresh their skills after a shocking number of deaths on roads in Norfolk so far this year. 7 bikers have lost their lives since the start of the year, and there are fears this could increase as more motorbikes return to the roads as the days get warmer. Police are also insisting that drivers need to do all they can to help prevent further tragedies. Family and friends of 7 men are coming to terms with the death of their loved ones while they were out on their motorbikes. A man in his 30s was the latest to lose his life when he lost control of his motorcycle on the Silt Road in Nordelf near Downham Market on April the 23rd. Joshua McAloon, 43, died in hospital after his white Honda CBR motorbike collided with a Nissan Qashqai in Fakenham on March the 22nd. In a heartfelt tribute, his family said, "You were a truly amazing brother and a fun-loving, crazy uncle loved by so many. You were super talented in everything you did. You have left a big gap in a lot of lives." A high number of the fatalities have happened in West Norfolk, including the death of a man in his 50s in Stoke Ferry on February the 26th and Honda rider on the A10 at South Runcton on April the 7th. A man in his 70s died in March after being involved in a crash in Gillingham on January the 16th. Mark Adamson, 32, lost his life while riding his red Honda CBR motorcycle on the B1108 at Barford on March the 17th. In Houghton, a man in his 50s was killed after crashing near a junction on Horning Road on April the 4th. Norfolk Constabulary is taking action by hosting several events, such as supporting the National Police Chiefs Council 2-wheel operation, which is due to take place in June. A bike safety event is also taking place on May the 3rd in Hunstanton, where specialist motorcycle riders, blood bikes and crews from Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service will be highlighting how to stay safe on the roads. We have already seen a number of motorcyclists lose their lives on our roads this year, and every one of these incidents is a tragic reminder of how vulnerable riders can be, Inspector Will Drummond said. As we move into the spring and more bikes return to Norfolk roads, we're urging riders to take time to check their bikes, refresh their skills, and ride to the conditions, particularly on roads that may have deteriorated over the winter. We're also asking drivers to recognise the vital role they play in preventing further tragedies. Look twice at junctions, give motorcycles space, and be patient on rural roads. A moment of extra care could be the difference between someone getting home safely and a life being lost.
A father who is battling stage 4 cancer was left waiting 4 months for word about his chemotherapy treatment. The father of 3 began to feel unwell in November last year, and initially he was given antibiotics, but the symptoms soon returned. Doctors suggested Crohn's disease and IBS as possible explanations, but a scan revealed an 8-centimetre tumour which had already spread to his lymph nodes. His wife, Anna, 40, told the Daily Mail, "It all happened very quickly. We were told that it was an aggressive, fast-growing cancer. We are trying to be really positive and just sort of taking it one day at a time. We're a very close family and lucky with the support we have. It's really scary, though, and I know the kids are really struggling with it." Mr. Sales has already had major surgery to fit a colostomy, and Ms. Sales said they were told treatment would move quickly with the first chemotherapy within 4 weeks of diagnosis. But then, she said, everything really went stagnant. With the chemotherapy delayed and specialist nurses became unreachable because they had gone on holiday, Ms. Sales said, "You are left to feel like you are a statistic rather than an actual human being." She did add that she couldn't fault the nursing staff on the hospital wards, as they had been amazing. The family is now trying to raise funds through a GoFundMe to support themselves through the coming months and Chris's treatment. Their fundraising page said, "We have three children at home, and as a family, we are doing everything we can to stay strong for them. One of our children is currently managing functional neurological disorder, while also preparing for GCSEs, which adds another layer of worry and pressure during an already incredibly difficult time. We are asking for help to cover essential living costs such as household bills, food and travel expenses, so we can focus on supporting Chris through his treatment and being there for our children when they need us most." As of April the 27th, she said, Mr. Sales has his first session of chemotherapy. She added that her niece, Lily, is taking part in Tough Mudder, the ultimate 4K obstacle course challenge, on May the 9th to raise awareness and funds for the family. Dr. Tana Marshall, NNUH, Interim Medical Director, told the Daily Mail, "We are sorry to hear of Mr. Sale and his family's concerns, and we are happy to discuss it further with them to answer any specific questions they have. Reducing weight for patients awaiting diagnosis and cancer treatment is a priority for our trust, and we have made significant progress in recent months. We are on track with our cancer performance improvement plans, and we are committed to make further progress to improve patient outcomes and experience. To contribute to the fundraiser, search Help Chris Fight Stage 4 Cancer on GoFundMe."
The mother of an 11-year-old boy who had a real kindness has spoken out nearly 4 years after his death in a poignant tribute. Harry Addy, who lived in Stalham with his family, had a healthy start to life until he developed back pain when he was 4. Doctors identified a curve in his spine, and it was diagnosed as scoliosis. But his mother, Melanie, was unconvinced because of the intense pain he was in. After requesting a scan, her worst fears came true, as it revealed an 8-centimetre tumour inside his spinal cord. Harry had an 8-hour operation at Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge. But 4 days later, his family was told he would need further surgery to remove more of the tumour. After the second operation, I remember the surgeon almost skipping into the room, saying, "The tumour was benign," said Melanie. We felt like celebrating because we thought everything was going to be okay. But everything changed after a follow-up scan in January 2017, which revealed the tumour had started growing again. He began weekly chemotherapy, which lasted 2.5 years, and it was during the early stages of the treatment the family received the devastating news that Harry had leptomeningeal disease. It was in his brain, and that was the cancer that actually killed him, his mother said. Tragically, his half-brother has also died from a brain tumour, and the family was told it may be hereditary.
Harry went on to have proton therapy in Manchester before the COVID pandemic lockdown. He spent this time making memories with his mum and sisters, Daisy, Tilly and Hattie. Then, in 2022, he started having horrendous seizures and ending up in intensive care. He died at home in September that year, on the same day meant to be his first at Stalham High School. Melanie said, "He deteriorated in the last few days, spending more time asleep than awake. However, the last thing he said to me was, 'I love you,' before closing his eyes for the final time. I always say that if he had to go, it was the perfect way. He laid on his bed and I held his hand, looking at him. My mum and best friend were in the room and it was so peaceful. It was lovely, if such a thing can be described that way. He could have died having a seizure or being in intense pain, which would have been horrendous." She described Harry as an amazing, clever, funny and happy boy with a wicked sense of humour, who loved to cook, swim and spend time with his friends. He also had a real kindness, and despite everything he was going through, his priority was always to make sure everyone else was okay, Melanie added. "He meant everything to me, and he was by my side 24/7. We tried to make the most of our time together, and I feel fortunate to have made many amazing memories. I'm so proud because he was an amazing boy who left such a legacy. Some people live to be 80 and don't get the love Harry received." She praised East Anglian Children's Hospice, EACH, which has become a key part of the family's life. Harry developed close relationships with members of the care team, and the charity helped with trips to Disneyland Paris, Colchester Zoo, and gave him the chance to drive a Ferrari at Silverstone. Melanie and Hattie also attend monthly bereavement groups at the Nook in Framlingham Earl. She added, "It's nice to know you're not the only one struggling, especially when you meet and get talking to people who have been coming a lot longer than I have."
Councillors have criticised the Norfolk Hall's borehole bid by saying it is undermining the planning process and setting damaging precedents. Matthew Taylor and Kevin Bayes, both North Norfolk District councillors, had strongly objected to plans to retain an outbuilding at Sutton Hall. The proposal had been submitted to the council last year and stated the building is used to house a borehole pump to supply potable water for the property. Work on the building had started in October 2024 and ended in January last year, with the application submitted retrospectively in December. But Mr. Taylor, who is the vice chairman of the council, and Mr. Bayes slammed the plans and said they were deeply concerned by the continued use of retrospective planning applications on this site. Two other retrospective proposals had been submitted to the council in recent years, which included a new tennis court, changing a home into a holiday let, and for an outbuilding for office and storage use. Their objection said, "Development has once again been carried out without prior consent, thereby undermining the planning process and the role of the local planning authority. We are also concerned that approving this retrospective application would set a damaging precedent, effectively encouraging further unauthorised development in the expectation that permission can be sought after the fact." The pair, who are ward members for the area, added that alongside other applications for the property, the outbuilding contributes an ongoing intensification of use of the site. The statement said, the repeated introduction of additional structures and facilities erodes the rural setting and further entrenches a level of activity that is wholly incompatible with this location. Sutton Parish Council echoed their concerns and said that locals were not given the opportunity to comment and therefore their views had not been properly considered. However, the planning officer at the council approved the plans submitted by Jermaine Hazel of Sutton Hall Escapes and said the ancillary building is required irrespective of the authorised use.
New data has revealed the shocking amount of crimes recorded at churches in Norfolk, which have been described as vulnerable to attack. The figures, gathered by a Freedom of Information request submitted by the Countryside Alliance, seem to suggest that sacred sites across the county are under siege by criminals. In 2025, there were 21 burglaries, 36 cases of violence against a person, 37 thefts, and 52 cases of arson and criminal damage at the places of worship. It means churches in Norfolk are hit an average of about 3 times a week by criminals. The Director of External Affairs for the Countryside Alliance, Mo Metcalf-Fisher, said, "Across the country, churches and places of worship continue to suffer as vandals, thieves and other criminals treat them as easy targets. We cannot allow this to continue. Churches and places of worship are focal points for local communities, particularly in rural towns and villages, where they play a crucial role in combating isolation. It is vital that the public keep a watchful eye and report any issues to the police. Notable incidents include stone-throwing vandals causing almost £12,000 of damage at the Minster Church of St Nicholas in Great Yarmouth by smashing a window on May the 22nd, 2025. Elsewhere in the county, two arson attacks rocked St Nicholas Church in Durham last year. The first happened on February the 21st when a Paschal candle and its holder were left damaged by a deliberately ignited blaze. Just 24 hours later, a Laudian cloth, a decorative piece of material, was also set alight. The communion table, which was covered by the cloth and the carpet underneath it, were left charred by the fire.
The future of a former pub's outbuilding has been left uncertain after its walls collapsed whilst it was being converted into a home. Clare Rear was renovating a barn which was part of the original site of the former Three Horseshoes pub in Scotto to turn it into a house under previously approved plans. Once known as Oddfellows Barn off North Walsham Road, it dates to the 1860s and operated as a function room before the pub itself was converted to a home. But during the works, the bricks began to crumble. Eventually, the building structure deteriorated and collapsed, resulting in the demolition of the property over time. And despite attempts to save and then reconstruct the building, now known as Scotto Barn, with the original bricks, North Norfolk's District Council's enforcement team said it now breached planning rules. This is because the approved plans no longer apply, as the original building was removed, and therefore Mrs. Lee had to submit a retrospective application for a new build. However, the council's planning officers argued that the plans should be refused as the demolition of the barn had resulted in the loss of historic fabric which detracts from the special character of the historic environment. They also said it would amount to a new home in the countryside without adequate justification, and it had not been demonstrated that it would be nutrient neutral, both of which are against policies. The officer added that while reusing viable bricks provides a connection back to the original structure, it cannot replace the intrinsic heritage value. The contentious matter was brought in front of the planning committee last week. Planning consultant Jason Parker spoke on behalf of Mrs. Lee and said, "This is quite a difficult case and life-changing. It's not speculative development, but a family who set out to do everything properly. This is not a case of someone trying to get around policy, but a case of the building physically falling during lawful works." After a debate, the councillors voted to defer a decision on the application for a later date to review further information and for the issues around nutrient neutrality being resolved.
A controversial membership fee shake-up at a tennis club will go ahead. Cromer Tennis Club has announced it will go ahead and axe a concessionary fee for members aged between 31 to 40. The decision means members in that age bracket will go from paying £165 for their yearly membership to a staggering £400, the standard adult fee. The proposal was originally put forward in an AGM report, but it was brought in front of the club's committee last week after concerns were raised by members. It was feared that people in that age range will give up the sport, leaving the club a cosy enclave for retired members. A spokesman for the club said the matter was discussed by the committee with a range of views presented and freely discussed. They decided to amend the membership groups as previously agreed, following careful consideration of the club's long-term sustainability and overall membership balance, the spokesman added. Our focus now is on moving forward positively as a club and looking ahead to a busy summer of play, tournaments and facility improvements. Among those criticising the change was Kelvin van Hasselt, who was chairman of the club between 2019 to 2024. In response to the committee's decision, Mr. Hasselt said, "I am very sad that this concessionary membership for 31 to 40-year-olds is to be abolished, and for members currently in the club who may not be able to renew their membership at £400. The club will continue to provide a concessionary fee for those living more than 20 miles away, including second home owners at £210, nearly half what adults in the catchment area will have to pay." Mr. Hasselt added, "What a pity that a 31-year-old in Cromer is paying £400, but a 31-year-old out of catchment is paying £210. The club offers a range of sports, including tennis, squash, racquetball, pickleball, and table tennis, and has recently been granted planning permission for two new paddle courts.
A woman in her 70s has died after a crash on a major road. The incident happened at around 3:20 p.m. on March the 27th on the A148, the Holt Road, in Almaton, and involved a red Nissan Qashqai and a red Volkswagen Polo. Following the collision, the drivers of both vehicles were taken to hospital for treatment, but the driver of the Polo, a woman in her 70s, has since died. The driver of the Qashqai, a woman in her 80s, has since been released from hospital. Officers are now appealing for any witnesses who have not already spoken to police to get in touch. Anyone with information or relevant dashcam footage is asked to contact the police, quoting the reference 36/25768/26.
A local businessman has been appointed as the first national president from Norfolk of a prestigious association. Kelly Clark from North Walsham has been named the national president of the Association of Past Round Tablers Clubs, commonly known as 41 Club. The organisation, conceived in 1985, is one of the top friendship groups in the UK. It supports 10,000 members across Great Britain and Ireland, offering a community for former round tablers and like-minded men. Mr. Clark received his chain of office during a 3-day conference in Southampton. Throughout the year, he plans to visit as many of the over 500 clubs as possible. Part of a global network of friendship and service clubs, 41 Club, GB and I, will see Mr. Clark travelling to Mauritius in May for the annual general meeting. In November, he will lay a poppy wreath at the Cenotaph in London on Remembrance Sunday. To mark his year in office, a charity ball is scheduled for October at Sproston Manor Hotel, with all proceeds going to the National Association of Blood Bikes.
A Norfolk swimming club has received a £2,000 boost. The North Norfolk Viking Swimming Club was awarded the grant from the Royal Warrant Holders Charity thanks to support of Simon and Alison Ridgway. Mr. and Mrs. Ridgway's local cooker maintenance company holds the seal of the Royal Trust and supported the club's application. The funding will be used to enhance the club's digital infrastructure, introducing new management platform, and the new system will serve as a central hub for parents, swimmers, coaches and volunteers, aiming to streamline communication and support competition entries. It will also help strengthen links with Swim England, aligning the club with national operational standards. A club spokesman said, "The impact of this grant will be enormous for our volunteers, coaching team and, most importantly, the young athletes who rely on the club for training and competitive opportunities." The Ridgeways visited Victory Swimming Pool in North Walsham, meeting several swimmers and volunteers. Young swimmers interested in competitive swimming can reach out to the club via its social media platforms or website, www.northnorfolkvikings.co.uk.
Barns at a Norfolk farm are set to become new homes after plans were given the green light. Broadland Council has approved a proposal to demolish one barn and convert three more into six homes at Common Farm, Hevingham. While one of the buildings will have four bedrooms, another will be split into half to offer two four-bedroom homes, and the third building will have three three-bedroom homes. Formerly, the buildings were used to house pigs and store grain and equipment. The plans, which had been submitted by Nathan Dickinson last year, had raised concerns in the community over the access to the site from the heath and the lack of adequate infrastructure. One neighbour said, "The access to the site is dangerous and unsuitable for the extra traffic that goes along with this proposal." However, the Highways Authority accepted that the traffic generated by the farm is broadly similar to the proposed residential use of the site, and that the site access can be improved to adoptable standards. The planning officer decided to approve the application.
A heritage railway is welcoming back a dining experience aboard its trains during a month full of classic events. The North Norfolk Railway, NNR, also known as the Poppy Line, is celebrating great British classics with 4 weeks of events, including live entertainment, interactive experiences, and the return of its Victorian train. During the late bank holiday from May the 23rd to May the 25th, visitors will see the return of the NNR's newest dining experience, Brunch on Board. A full English breakfast will be served to guests on May the 24th while travelling in a heritage dining car, and passengers will also be able to enjoy unlimited hop-on, hop-off steam train travel along the line. The Victorian train will also run once again, and people will have the chance to operate a fully restored signal box. For the younger visitors, from May the 26th to May the 29th, Holt Station will be hosting science demonstrations and hands-on activities from Mad Science, including a travel ticket.
Hundreds of people in Norfolk have scooped a share of almost £1 million in this month's Premium Bonds prize draw. Five people won an incredible £50,000 alongside one lucky person who got a £100,000 prize. a total of 326 people across the county scooped a share of £982,000, averaging £3,012 each. Three others bagged £25,000 and 16 people won £10,000. A further 24 won £5,000 and hundreds more received £1,000. Last month, a total of 342 people across the county scooped a share of £1,134,000, averaging £3,325 each. Premium bonds are an investment product from National Savings and Investments, NS&I. Unlike other investments, where investors earn interest or a regular dividend income, bonds are entered into a monthly prize draw where people can win between £25 and £1 million. Andrew Westhead, NS&I retail director, said, "The quickest way to check if you have won a prize is to use our Premium Bonds Prize Checker app. Check online or even ask Alexa from the second working day of each month onwards."
A sprawling Victorian seaside town has been named as one of the UK's best for a day trip. Sheringham was included in the roundup, which was published by the Sun newspaper. Travel writer Jenna Stevens said the North Norfolk destination is a hit with families, and it is clear to see why. Entire days can easily be spent on golden stretches of sand backed by beach huts, with bucket and spade in hand, she said. But it's worth pulling yourself away from the shores for a ride on the Heritage Steam Railway, where the Pretty Poppy line runs from Sheringham to Holt. Plus, theatre fans will love a visit to Sheringham Little Theatre, where family-friendly productions, quiz and bingo nights fill the historic theatre with a lively buzz. Stroll along to the Stevenson's Fish and Chip Shop to grab a takeaway, tea and catch the sunset, and you've done a visit to this seaside town, right? The other spots on the list were Fowey in Cornwall, Whitney in the Cotswolds, Chester in Cheshire, Weston-super-Mare in North Somerset and Welling Garden City in Hertfordshire. It comes shortly after the organisation hailed Old Hunstanton as one of the UK's best beaches.
A pizza chain is coming to a seaside town this summer, despite opposition from locals. Domino's will open in Sheringham this summer after North Norfolk District Council's decision was overturned. The firm's application to open a restaurant in Church Street was initially rejected in 2024, following a campaign by Sheringham Town Council and local people. They feared the arrival of the pizza chain could threaten the heritage of the town's high street and harm the local businesses already operating there. In June last year, the Planning Inspectorate, the government department that presides over planning disputes, overruled the decision. At the time, the inspector said, "There is no evidence before me that would suggest that a predominance of shops would not remain." The pizza restaurant will be based at 10 Church Street, with a sign from Domino's up in the window stating, "New look store coming soon." A spokesman for Domino's said, "We are excited to come to Sheringham this summer. The branch's exact opening date is yet to be confirmed."
Controversial plans to transform and reopen a much-loved 300-year-old Norfolk pub have been given the go-ahead. North Norfolk District Council's Development Committee voted on Thursday to approve the Stoddy Estate's application to remodel the Hunworth Bell near Holt. The pub, known locally as the Honey Bell, has been closed since May 2024. The closure of the village's only pub and the estate's subsequent plans to build 10 homes on the site sparked a fierce community backlash. Protesters hung signs around the village reading, "Save our pub from the Stoddy Estate," and more than 140 villagers raised £750,000 to buy the pub outright, an offer the estate rejected. The pub was subsequently designated an asset of community value, meaning it must remain as a pub. The estate went back to the drawing board, and the newly approved scheme will see four overnight guest bedrooms created within the pub while reducing the bar area. Six homes will be built on a neighbouing farmyard, with two sold as affordable housing, two retained by the estate for rent, and two on the open market. Speaking at the meeting, the managing director of the Stoddy Estate described the application as a very major investment into the estate's much-loved pub. He said the Honey Bell had faced serious financial challenges during the estate's generations of ownership, with several failed attempts to run it successfully. "We've had four experienced operators either fail completely or leave," he said. "We have routinely subsidised the pub, but still it has failed in its current form. This proposal is about fixing that by introducing four guest bedrooms to create a more sustainable rural model." He said the estate had made significant concessions from its original proposals, reducing the number of homes from 10 to 6, doubling the affordable housing requirement, and delivering a complete redesign of the drainage system. Andrew Brown, the Liberal Democrat councillor for the ward, had initially opposed the plans, but spoke in support of the revised application. "It's taken nearly 2 years to arrive at the proposal you have before you today, following the closure of this much-loved village pub," he said. The village and wider community looked on in disbelief when it closed in 2024. They were shocked into immediate action to register the Honey Bell as an asset of community value in an attempt to save it. He urged members not to let the pub become another casualty of a national crisis, noting that around 3,000 pubs have shut since 2020. "We should take this opportunity not to allow this valued facility to become a sad statistic. It's time to call last orders on this application and grant approval." The parish council, which had also opposed earlier versions of the scheme, backed the revised plans. A representative told the committee the application had split opinion in the village, but said its core concerns had been addressed. "Locals have pushed for the work on the pub to be completed before the homes are moved into, which is expected to be agreed via a Section 106 agreement following the approval. It's time to put your money where your mouth is. Do the pub work first," he said. The pub has rich history. Prince Harry once visited, and the late John Hurt filmed the comedy Chitlet there, which screened at Cannes in 2015. Officers had recommended approval ahead of the meeting, concluding that the benefits outweigh the harms and that the new letting rooms would make the pub more viable and appeal to operators.
Norfolk farm leaders have welcomed new police powers to help tackle the scourge of machinery theft. The newly enacted Crime and Policing Bill allows police officers to enter premises without a warrant to recover electronically tracked stolen agricultural equipment. Agricultural vehicle thefts reported to rural insurer NFU Mutual cost an estimated £7 million in 2024. But the National Farmers Union, NFU, says the new laws should allow police to act immediately when the location of stolen equipment is known, which should improve recovery rates and disrupt organised rural crime. NFU Norfolk Council representative Nick Dean, who farms at Hofton, said, "I welcome news that the Crime and Policing Bill has now become law. I often hear about farm equipment theft taking place in Norfolk, and these new police powers will make a positive impact in tackling this issue." He described the new legislation as a good step in the right direction, but said further action is needed to protect rural communities. Rural crime is a major ongoing concern for farmers in Norfolk, dealing with fly tipping and hare coursing, among other crimes being carried out by organised criminal gangs, said Mr. Dean. "These crimes are costing the industry in this region tens of thousands of pounds, damaging the countryside and impacting our ability to deliver national food security." The NFU continues to engage with the police, MPs, councillors and other stakeholders to raise these concerns and work towards giving our rural communities the protection they need. While the legislation also gives ministers greater powers to issue statutory guidance to councils on the enforcement of fly tipping, the NFU says it does not go far enough to address the undue burden waste crime places on farmers and growers.
A private helicopter flew 50 miles from a Suffolk estate to the scene of a paraglider crash on the Norfolk coast, which left a man needing an airlift to hospital. The accident happened at Munsley when one of a group of four paragliders got into difficulties and came down on the beach. The emergency services were sent to the coast, including two ambulances, a paramedic car and the East Anglian Air Ambulance. As the medics treated the victim on the sand, a second helicopter arrived at the crash site and landed beside the air ambulance in a nearby field. The aircraft, a Saxon Air VIP charter helicopter, had flown directly to Munsley from the Hevingham Hall estate in Suffolk. It took off from there just 10 minutes after the air ambulance arrived at the crash site at 3:37 p.m. and travelled 50 miles to the Norfolk coast. The private helicopter then took off again from Munsley 2 minutes after the air ambulance had left to airlift the victim to the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital, where he remains. The aircraft returned to Hevingham, stopping only for a few minutes before continuing on to London. It then stopped briefly, then before flying to Norwich. Sprawling Hevingham estate is owned by property entrepreneur and Foxton's founder, John Hunt, and his wife, Lois. The hall itself sits in 500 acres of parkland, amid an even greater larger estate. Mrs. Hunt was contacted but declined to comment. Witnesses in Munsley said four paragliders had been flying near the beach in strong winds shortly before the crash. The area is a popular spot for the activity as flyers can take off from the nearby cliffs. Ruth Britton said, "It was extremely windy and we saw the paragliders going over. I saw the ambulances and air ambulance before seeing people running towards the beach." A worker at Munsley convenience store in Cromer Road said, "I heard the air ambulance, which landed a bit further up the road. We get paragliders coming off the top of cliffs here quite often. It is quite high up and a good point to jump from. I hope the person involved is okay. The incident happened on Tuesday, April the 28th. Saxon Air has been contacted for a comment."
Controversial plans for a housing estate have cleared the first planning hurdle, despite warnings from villagers that future residents will be pulling out onto a notorious road where an elderly couple were recently killed. A developer has been given permission, in principle, to build nine new bungalows on a patch of land off Heathfield Road in High Kelling, near Holt. The plans have long sparked opposition from locals who believe the adjacent A148 is too dangerous. The road, which runs between King's Lynn and Cromer, has been a cause for concern in the village for years. Four people have died on the 44-mile road over the past decade, prompting repeated calls for lower speed limits, better crossing points, and broader safety improvements along its entire length. In December 2024, when Sheila and Campbell Welsh, aged 81 and 82, were killed after being struck by a Mini Cooper, a coroner later found the driver could not reasonably have avoided them, as the couple were crossing in dark clothing on the unlit road. A man had been arrested on suspicion of causing death by dangerous driving, but faced no further action. However, their deaths led to widespread concern in High Kelling about the safety of the road. Their granddaughter launched a petition calling for safety improvements, which was signed by more than 1,000 people, and Norfolk County Council carried out a comprehensive safety review. future residents of the new homes would join the A148 via Avenue Road, pulling out onto the carriageway just yards from where the couple lost their lives. Prior to the decision by North Norfolk District Council's Planning Committee, more than 80 villagers had packed into a public meeting to voice their frustrations. More than 40 formal objections were lodged, and the parish council also opposed the plans. Peter Rutherford, a parish councillor who spoke at Thursday's meeting, said it was his understanding no further development had been permitted on that side of the A148, precisely because of the dangers at the Avenue Road junction. This site is not suitable for residential development, he said. It is impossible to gain safe access onto the A148 for any additional housing. There is still scope for the application to be blocked, however. Permission in principle is an early stage consent, covering only location, land use and scale. A second stage, technical details consent, must still be passed before anything can be built. And it is at that stage that highway safety will face full scrutiny. The Highways Authority also warned it would likely raise safety objections when the scheme returns for its second stage, flagging poor visibility at junctions and the unadopted nature of the access roads. Andrew Brown, a Lib Dem councillor, acknowledged the weight of the decision. Whatever we decide today, if we do approve it, it should in no way be an indication that when it comes back for technical details, it will be approved, he said.
You are listening to edition number 2016 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 8th of May 2026. We have articles about a retiring judge, a garden competition, an epic fundraising effort, and good news for Cromer young footballers, plus the Mardler magazine supplement. But as there are no obituaries or letters to the editor this week, we next have details of some up-and-coming events.
Forthcoming events include, on Sunday the 10th of April, New Sheringham Singers, 100 Years of Musicals at All Saints Church, Upper Sheringham at 3pm, £10. Under-12s free. And on Saturday the 16th of April, Tabletop Sale at North Walsham Community Centre, 9 to 12. And 7pm at the Black Swan, North Walsham, a Roy Old Do, a mix of songs, comedy stories and a touch of good old squit from the Friends of Norfolk Dialect.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement. We include Superheroes, Restoring the Curlew, and Mike Liggins is Grateful. But first, the River Wensum is one of our most precious treasures. Sometimes, when I sit to write about January or February, I wonder what on earth I'm going to say about those bleakest of months. But in glorious May, quite the opposite problem pertains. In May, I wonder how to settle on just one subject, when on every side my every sense is assailed by nature's bounty. Should I write about swallowtails surfing the mild spring breeze over Ranworth Reeds? Should I write about pool frogs at Thompson, clattering for a mate from the warm brown water of ancient Pingos? Should I write about meadows, alive with the rattle of common green grasshoppers beneath the ceaseless skylark's song in the spring blue sky? Where to look? Where to go? What wonders to choose from May's outrageous surge of life and blossom and song? Today, my eyes and my words are drawn to a dazzling swirl of metallic colours, of chitin and of jeans above the river by which I live. In the past 10 years, I have often written about the River Wensum, It's hard to live in Norfolk with eyes and ears open to nature and not be drawn to the Wensum. Rising in northwest Norfolk from the ridge of chalk that defines the west of our county, the Wensum is our longest ecological corridor. Our beautiful river winds on its trouty bed of gravel and chalk through the very heart of Norfolk and behind my little flint house before reaching our fine city of Norwich. West of the city at Helsdon, the Wensum is joined from the south by the Tud. Southeast of the city, close to our Norfolk Wildlife Trust Reserve at Thorpe Marshes, it is joined by the Yare. Taking the smaller river's name, the Yare continues east through the goose-loud marshes of Strumpshaw, Buckenham and Cantley, and is joined by the Chet before reaching Breydon Water and the sea. Everywhere along the river, everywhere along any Norfolk River in May, the same metallic damselflies I am seeing can be found. Half of the insects, the female, are a lustrous shining green along the body with bronze-green wings. The other half, the males, are beetle blue. Transparent at the base, each of the male's four wings bears a night blue smudge like an inky thumbprint near the tip. This is the mark from which the banded demoiselle takes its common name. Its scientific name, Calopteryx splendens, is more wonderful still. Rooted in ancient Greek and Latin, it translates as splendid wings of beauty, describing perfectly these insects as they jink and shimmer above the rippling water of a Norfolk river. Banded demoiselles speak of corridors of habitat along rivers through the landscape. To exist, they need the fresh, clear water of our rivers. They need the froth of hemlock, cow parsley, stinging nettles and great willow herb beside them. For here they rest and court and hunt. They are the insect symbol of the flow of water through our county. They also speak of corridors through time, of genes, of species, and of stories. The oldest fossils of dragonfly-shaped insects, known popularly as griffinflies, are from the Carboniferous period, some 350 million years ago. These were far larger animals than any dragonfly today, with a wingspan of up to 70 centimetres. One theory is that the higher atmospheric oxygen in the Carboniferous permitted flight in giant invertebrates devoid of pumping lungs. Another suggests that in the absence of aerial vertebrate predators like birds, such ungainly insects could afford to fly. While the relationship between Carboniferous griffinflies and modern dragonflies remains obscure, there is no doubt that the dragonfly-like insects have hawked our skies for hundreds of millions of years. The glittering damselflies I see above the shallow water of the Wensum unquestionably carry genes that have existed for 300 million years. At just 100 years of age this year, Norfolk Wildlife Trust has some catching up to do, as does Sir David Attenborough, who with our warm congratulations reaches 100 this May. All the same, we are proud to protect the banded demoiselles and their habitat and to welcome people to meet them on many of our reserves. You can see them by the Wensum and the Yare in Norwich, on our Sweetbriar and Thorpe Marshes nature reserves. You can see them from our little bridge across the Whitewater, a tributary of the Wensum, between our reserves at Beatley Meadows and Hoe Rough. You can see them along the River Wissey as you look across the reed beds we have created there for bitterns, marsh harriers and bearded tits. You can see them on the Hun, a tiny, fragile river flowing by home dunes. You can see them on the Bure at Ranworth and at Upton and at many others of the precious places we protect for them and you. When this month you see a cloud of banded demoiselles, reflect on what they mean. Yes, they are beautiful. And yes, they bring a flash of happiness to your day. And this alone is reason enough to love them. But their presence along our Norfolk rivers speaks of so much more. They let our thoughts flow with the rivers across the land, through our natural habitats and towns and farms to the sea. They let our thoughts stretch back through hundreds of millions of years to the very roots of animal life. At Norfolk Wildlife Trust, we are only 100 years of age. We are mindful that in our hands, on our 60 nature reserves, on the 140 wildlife county sites whose owners we support, on the countless pockets of Norfolk land whose custodians we advise, we hold 300 million years and more of genes, of life, of species and of story. Priceless beyond measure, our promise is to hand them on, connecting them in space and time, so that 300 years from now, some intelligent form of life can see the jewel-like forms of damselflies and be filled, like me today, with wonder. That article by Nick Aitchison appeared in the May 2026 issue of the Norfolk Magazine.
Next, superheroes helping young people get active. One in three children in Norfolk now leaves primary school overweight or obese. It is a stark figure for a county known for its outdoor pursuits, beautiful beaches, stunning waterways and wide open spaces. In Norfolk, many young people face growing pressures that limit their ability to be active. Smartphones and gaming compete for attention. The rising cost of living places more families under strain. Deprivation means children have few local opportunities. For some, taking part in sports and activities is simply out of reach. Against this backdrop, a long-standing North Norfolk sporting event is working to support change. The Norfolk Superhero Challenge, a tough charity quadrathlon that sees teams swim, kayak, cycle and run along the coast, has raised more than £1.3 million for local causes over the years. In 2025, it launched a new partnership with Norfolk Community Foundation, setting its sights firmly on helping to tackle inactivity among children and young people. Together, the organisers set up the Norfolk Superhero Fund, aiming to raise £500,000 over 3 years to help children overcome barriers to sport, outdoor activities and active hobbies, giving more young people the chance to lay the foundations for healthy futures. This year marks the first anniversary of the partnership. A panel of Superhero Fund members reviewed applications and awarded grants to 25 community-led projects across all districts of Norfolk. Many benefit young people experiencing poverty, challenging home lives, disability or hidden disadvantage that restricts their ability to take part. With the first year of delivery now underway, the early impact is already visible. Great Yarmouth sits on the edge of the country in more ways than one. It has long faced deep-rooted social and economic challenges. For many young people, especially those from families living in temporary accommodation or under significant pressure, the options for safe and structured activity can be limited. Evenings are often spent outside, not always by choice, but by lack of alternatives. Norfolk Superhero Funding is helping to change that. The Sports Spot Project, run by Mancroft Advice Project, MAP, is one of the groups supported through the fund. MAP helps young people through everything from housing, debt and welfare issues to mental health, education, employment, advocacy and more. The Sports Spot provides a regular active space where young people can meet friends, be active and take part in something positive. One attendee, Lee, described the difference plainly. A lot of those people are recognised from just playing on the streets and they come here instead. Lee hints at the shift the Sports Spot is making locally, when off the streets and taking part in structured activity where they can also access other support. Young people can channel their energy into something positive and take charge of the course of their life. For MAP youth worker Tamara, using activity as a starting point is precisely what makes the Sports Spot sessions work. She sees a sport as a gateway to something bigger. A young person finding a safe place and choosing to do something positive in the evening. An inactive teenager trying a new sports activity. Or someone with low confidence, giving something a go. You've tried it and that matters, she tells them. For her, the Norfolk Superhero funding makes a difference because in a town where youth spaces are scarce and opportunities are uneven, it provides a safe, consistent space where those small first steps into activity can grow into long-term change towards a better life. On the other side of Norfolk, children are facing a different set of challenges. In Downham Market, the team at Swan Youth Project supports young people through everything from emotional wellbeing struggles and social pressures to safety concerns, hygiene needs and life challenges. Recently, the Swan team has become increasingly concerned about how many children are disengaging from physical activity. Some are not currently attending school, while others are in school but reluctant to take part in physical education. Anna, chief executive of Swan, sees this regularly. Some children will say they want to be signed off PE at school, but they will come here and do it, she explains. It is not that they do not like it, it just has to feel right. The weekly sports sessions, led by Alive West Norfolk coach Joe and funded through the Superhero Initiative, create a different kind of environment. Sessions are welcoming, low pressure, and built on encouragement rather than competition. Joe sees the ripple effect frequently. This might be one of the only times they come out and get involved in something like this, he says. They might then go into school and say, I might do an after-school club, because they know they have done it here first. For many young people, Swan provides a doorway back into being active. Some discover they enjoy sports they once avoided. Others find the confidence to join teams or clubs. Dan is one such example. Coach Joe recognised his natural footballing ability and worked with colleagues at Swan to help him join a local team. Anna recalls the moment, Joe was able to tell me how talented Dan was at football, so we were able to get him onto a team. If that can change his life, that will be unbelievable, won't it? Joe is vital. For Swan, sport provides a route to confidence, connection and opportunity. It is a way to help young people step past the barriers that might otherwise hold them back. The first year of the Norfolk Superhero Fund shows how the right support can unlock far more than fitness. Activity helps rebuild routines, strengthens friendships, and gives young people the belief that they can achieve more than they imagine. Projects like MAPS Sports Spot and Swan Youth Project are demonstrating what happens when communities have the resources they need to offer inclusive, meaningful opportunities for children to be active. As the partnership enters its second year, the fund will reopen the community groups in early June, inviting more organisations to join the mission to help Norfolk's young people thrive. On June the 20th, the Norfolk Superhero Challenge returns to the North Norfolk coast, bringing together athletes, supporters and volunteers to fuel the next wave of community impact. That article was from the Norfolk Magazine, May 2026 issue.
And now, the call of the curlew. I'm a regular visitor to Snettisham RSPB Nature Reserve in West Norfolk. On a recent early morning visit, I was lucky enough to be able to photograph a distant curlew, which was probing the mud with its distinctive long curved beak, as so many wading birds come here to do. It was glowing in the low sunlight, showing off its elegant frame, its long legs, speckled body and longish neck. Its dark eye was catching the light, always a bonus in bird photography. The hunting, fluting, far-carrying call of the curlew is a key element of the soundtrack to our moors and wild coastal places. Without it, these places lose something of their magic. The troubling news is that we have lost about two-thirds of our curlews in just 30 years. The better news is that conservationists are on the case, taking direct action to help the species. When I got home after my Snettisham trip, I was looking at my photographs. I noticed the curlew had a yellow tag on its leg. I could just about make out the letters on the tag. With some guidance from a friend at the RSPB, I learned that this bird had had a short life but a very interesting life so far. It is one of the curlews that is part of a recovery project centring on this part of Norfolk. I reported the sighting and sent off the photograph to the project website. Many thanks for reporting where one of our head-started curlews has been seen, senior research ecologist Catherine Bogen replied. Head-starting is a new conservation method. It involves curlews' eggs being removed from airfield nests soon after they are laid. The eggs are incubated in captivity and the chicks are hand-reared before being returned to the wild in safer places. It's lovely to know where they've been outside of our core monitoring period, Catherine added. We really value these sightings as they are helping us to assess how these head-started birds move following release. And we hope to see him for many more years to come, and hopefully that he may be one of those that starts to breed. Catherine sent me a short note on the other sightings reported for this particular bird, with the release date and location and a map explaining that UP, its tag code, is a male, released in July 2025. He has stayed around the eastern Wash coastline since then, and as we've started getting a nice crop of sightings coming in for him, and so many thanks for adding in yours. If curlews reach adulthood, they are pretty good at surviving. The challenge is getting there. Young birds face many challenges, and eggs in nests can also be vulnerable. Eastern England's curlews are doing better than elsewhere in lowland England, but there is a local hazard. They are attracted to the large grassland habitats provided by airfields. This presents a risk of collision with aircraft. As a result, the birds have been actively discouraged from nesting in these places. Collected eggs from these vulnerable nests are hatched and reared by an expert team. Most eggs from the airfields are delivered before incubation has started, and with an incubation period of 30 days, careful management of the eggs is crucial. Deepdale Conservation Trust staff incubate and care for the eggs and the chicks throughout the stages of rearing. When they hatch, the young birds are kept indoors with mop mums under which to shelter. They are fed a special diet to ensure healthy growth and development. At about a week old, they are moved to outdoor polytunnel aviaries, where they stay until about 35 days old. Here they have small huts with infrared heat lamps to shelter under during inclement weather. Each has an identity ring to identify individuals all the way through their development. At around 4 or 5 weeks old, the chicks are given their coloured tags and metal ring. They are transferred from the polytunnels to a nursery flight pen. The flight pen houses curlews of a similar size and age, where they continue to grow. After receiving their leg flags, until fledging with a minimum human contact. Chicks are released when they are about 50 days old and monitored by the BTO scientists. Soon after, they are transported to one of the project release sites at Sandringham and Ken Hill Estates in West Norfolk. The release sites have been chosen for their proximity to the intertidal mudflats and salt marshes of the Wash, one of Britain's most important feeding areas for waders. The birds spend a short period in the release pen to acclimatise. On release day, the birds are free to explore their environment. Because relatively few young curlews fledge each year and juveniles are quite difficult to catch and fit tags to, very little is known about how young curlews behave and move around the landscape. So to monitor the movements of young birds post-release, some are fitted with either GPS or radio tags. Scientists can then revisit release sites with a radio receiver and listen for tags which are still in the vicinity. Radio tags will fall off naturally after about 3 to 6 months, and GPS tags after about 12 to 18 months. Scientists analysed the movement of GPS-tagged birds in the days, weeks and months following release to build a picture of how the birds are exploring their surroundings and what habitats they prefer. Being able to track head-started curlews is providing a precious opportunity to understand the behaviour and needs of the curlews at this critical age. It is hoped that the project will help to ensure that the curlew and its haunting, far-carrying call remain a feature of the wild landscapes of the Norfolk coast and beyond. The Curlew Recovery Project is a partnership involving REF, Deepdale, WWT Natural England, Wild Cairn Hill and the British National Trust for Ornithology. And this article was written by Mark Jameson and it appeared in the Norfolk magazine in May 2026.
And to finish this week's supplement, I'm grateful Jeanette requested a dog, a diamond and a dishwasher. When I proposed marriage to my wife, Jeanette, she half jokingly asked for the three D's. She said yes, because she knew a good thing when she saw it. But I knew that failure to deliver on the three D's could mean trouble at mill in the early days of our marriage. What were the three D's, I hear you ask? A dog, a diamond, and a dishwasher. Never mind in sickness and in health and all that malarkey. A dog, a diamond and dishwasher was the very practical contract we entered into back in 1996 when we got hitched. The diamond I've talked about before. The dishwasher I will leave to another time. So the subject for this month's column is the dog. Or dogs, to be more accurate. I'd never been a very doggy person. Growing up, we had a golden retriever called Muffin. She was lovely, but lived outside in a kennel and wasn't exactly the centre of attention. Jeanette had always wanted a West Highland White Terrier, Westie for short, and so we bought a puppy and called her Molly. My memories are a bit hazy now, but Molly lived with us in a small terraced house on the outskirts of Norwich. She was kind and gentle soul. We loved her and she loved us. But as many of you will know, being a dog owner is rarely without some kind of drama. I do remember taking Molly on holiday with us to Cornwall. It was a long way in the car, and when we arrived at the hotel, our little bundle of joy was so excited she ran into a glass door and smashed the pane to pieces. It could have been very serious, but happily the silly pooch only needed a few stitches. We paid for the door, and happily Molly didn't do anything quite as daft ever again. A second Westie soon followed. Her name was Jess, and she was a different dog altogether. Jess was more roughy-tufty, but was good company for Molly, and they became close friends. Westies are a fabulous breed. They can be stubborn at times and not easy to train, but they are very portable, good with people of all ages, and very loving. So over the years, I gradually got used to sharing my life with two Westies. After all, what choice did I have? Both Molly and Jess lived long and happy lives, and losing them was hell. If you're a pet lover, you'll know just how hard it can be. But let's not dwell on that here. We have two Westies now, Betty and Daisy. And they are a big part of family life. They are allowed on the bed in the morning while Jeanette and I drink our cup of tea. This particular ritual started out as a treat for them on high days and holidays, but it happens every day now. They are also allowed on the sofa in the evenings. And I know that some of you reading this will be appalled at such behaviour, while others will think it entirely normal. Betty and Daisy are walked twice a day. They get about an hour in the morning and perhaps 20 minutes in the evening. In the winter, dog walking can sometimes feel like a chore, but at this time of year, it's anything but. I love being out with them and find I need the fresh air and the solitude. Betty loves to run for a ball, unusual in Westies, while Daisy couldn't care less. They are Jeanette's dogs, really, and are very close to her. But I occasionally get some attention, and they are always pleased to see me. As you can see, I am now very much a doggy person, and I am grateful for that request all those years ago for a dog, a diamond, and a dishwasher. And that item by Mike Liggins is taken from the Norfolk Magazine June 2025 issue. Our thanks go to the editors and contributors of the EDP and Norfolk Magazine for permission to use their material.
Finish with our final selection of news and views, starting with Judiciary has been lucky to have you, Alice. The great and the good were amongst those who helped give Norfolk's most senior judge an emotional send-off before she retired. Dame Victoria Sharp, president of the King's Bench Division, was joined by a host of Norfolk dignitaries at a special service held at Norwich Crown Court, marking the retirement of Judge Alice Robinson, who has been the city's resident judge since 2021. Dame Victoria said it was a pleasure to be here to pay tribute to Judge Alice Robinson. Quoting an old newspaper article, she said, "Judge Robinson was Norfolk's top judge." She said the judge had given many years of distinguished service to the judiciary and described her as an inspiration. "The judiciary had been lucky to have you, Alice," she said, describing her as a leader and a friend. "Top judge, top resident judge, and all-round good person. You will be missed." Michael Gurney, Vice Lord Lieutenant of Norfolk, Joe Pearson, High Sheriff of Norfolk, and Norfolk Chief Constable Paul Sanford were in attendance at last week's send-off. Alongside them were the Honourable Judge Jennifer Eady, as well as Norwich Judges Catherine Moore, Anthony Bate and Andrew Shaw. Barristers, legal representatives and court staff, past and present, attended in person, with many more over a video link. Judge Robinson's husband and two children were among those joining the event. Stephen Rose, KC, Chairman of the East Anglian Bar Mess, said Judge Robinson was a model of listening, reflecting and reaching a firm conclusion. He said her decision to retire had been customarily decisive. He said, "All at the Bar Mess express our warmest wishes for a long and happy retirement." Jim Webster, listing officer, thanked Judge Robinson for her hard work and said the court was in a far better position now than when she joined us. Mr. Webster said she was extremely kind and thoughtful. Judge Robinson thanked all who spoke for their extremely kind words. She said it had been a huge honour and privilege to have been resident judge, which had been a deeply fulfilling role. She said, "I will miss you all very much." Judge Moore has been appointed next resident judge and is due to take up her role on May the 12th.
The Wildlife Garden Competition is returning to Cromer. Cromer Green Spaces Contest seeks to find the town's best gardens for wildlife following its successful launch in 2021. The competition is open to all gardens, big or small, with the aim of providing maximum benefit to the local wildlife. The organisers have outlined three key elements for gardens to be considered: water, food and shelter. Water features can include anything from a pond or bird bath to a simple hedgehog drinking dish, while food can be provided by nectar-rich flowers, berry-bearing bushes, or a well-stocked bird table. Shelter can be created using vegetation or purpose-built structures like a bug hotel or bird box. The competition encourages families to involve children in creating a special place for wildlife around their home. To enter, entrants must email a description of their wildlife-friendly space, no longer than 150 words, along with up to 5 photos to chromags@gmail.com. Entries are being accepted until June the 30th. There are 2 categories in the competition, Best Large Garden and Best Small Garden. Winners, who will be announced during Carnival Week in August, will receive prizes and a trophy. Prizes will also be awarded to the runner-up and third-place entries. However, organisers emphasise that the biggest winner will be the local wildlife. The competition is free to enter, but is limited to gardens within the boundaries of Cromer and Suffield Park. Entries must include the entrant's name, address and contact number. Those under 18 need permission from a parent, guardian or carer to enter. A panel of local experts will judge the competition in July, visiting 6 shortlisted gardens with prior agreement.
Epic fundraising treks have helped a Norfolk-based rural property and business consultancy to raise more than £40,000 for a farming charity. Brown & Co. chose RABI, the Royal Agricultural Benevolent Institution, as its Charity of the Year for 2025-2026, with a year-long programme of fundraising activities including bake sales, quiz nights, a netball tournament and game nights. Staff across the firm's 12 UK offices took part, aiming to raise money and build awareness of the practical financial and emotional support which RABI offers farming communities. The office teams in Norwich, Holt and King's Lynn completed a 12-mile coastal walk from Wells next to the sea to Clyde, and standout personal challenges included a 12-day trek to the Everest Base Camp by James Brown, ABC partner in the Banbury office, while Steve Willerton, a surveyor based in Bury St Edmunds, completed a wing walk. Brown & Co partner Andrew Fundell said, "We are very proud of all the efforts of the 340 partners and staff at Brown & Co have made over the year to raise this fantastic total for this important charity in our rural community. Thank you to our clients, family and friends for your incredible support in helping us fundraise for RABI. In addition to raising funds, Brown & Co staff have spent time in farming communities during the autumn, distributing care packages and raising awareness of RABI's services. Paul Peary, head of fundraising at RABI, said, "On behalf of everyone at RABI, the farmers' charity, I'd like to extend our heartfelt thanks to the incredible team at Brown & Co for their dedication and creativity in supporting our work over the past year. From quiz nights and raffles to the extraordinary challenge of trekking to the Everest Base Camp, their efforts have been nothing short of inspiring. And every pound raised will help us to provide vital, practical, financial and emotional support to farming people across England and Wales."
New sponsorship is helping kickstart fresh ambitions at a coastal football club. Cromer Youth Football Club will benefit from funding thanks to support from home care provider Caremark, which has sponsored the club alongside Carwon. A spokesperson for the club said, "We're delighted to welcome Carwon and Caremark as early supporters of the club. Their belief in our vision at this stage means a great deal to everyone involved. As a club, we are only just getting started. Our ambition is clear: to build a men's team competing at a high level, establish a women's side challenging at the top, and continue expanding our youth pathway by growing our junior teams. This is an exciting journey, and with the backing we now have, we are confident about what lies ahead. Caremark, which supports people in their own homes across North Norfolk and Great Yarmouth, said the sponsorship reflects its commitment to supporting the wider community and future generations. It also highlighted the club's wider purpose beyond football, seeing the sponsorship as a way to help create positive opportunities for young people in the area. A company spokesman said, "What really stood out to us about Cromer Youth Football Club is the ambition behind it. It's clear this isn't just about football, it's about creating opportunities, building something long term, and giving young people a positive environment to grow in, which we really believe in." Celebrating the news, the Mayor of Cromer, Richard Leeds, said, "With the standing relationship that Cromer Town Council has with Cromer Youth Football Club, it is very welcome to see a local company sponsoring them. This will ensure that Cromer youth players can continue to have a home and grow in respect of teams and supporting personnel development of our youth."
To be a true Norfolk local means more than just living here. Here are seven classic experiences you'll need to tick off before you can really claim the title. 1. A boat trip on the Broads. Whether it's hiring a day cruiser, taking a trip on a tour boat, or joining friends on a private craft, there is no better feeling as a local than being out on the Broads. For many of us, drifting along the rivers and reed beds at a slow pace is one of the simplest ways to relax, spot wildlife, and enjoy the county's big skies. A great selection of pubs sit right on the water's edge along the way, including the Rising Sun at Coltishall, which also offers delicious wood-fired pizza. 2. Fighting off the pigeons at Norwich Market. Norwich Market is the perfect place to enjoy a tasty spot of lunch, browse products by independent traders, and come together with other city folk. The pigeons know how good the food is too. They are always trying their luck for a taste. For locals, it's part of the fun. 3. Gressenhall Farm and Workhouse. Gressenhall Farm and Workhouse near Dereham mixes hands-on farm experiences with historical stories of workhouse life. It is a well-known spot for school trips. To this day, most true locals will remember going and dressing up in a period costume for a really immersive experience. 4. Seal spotting at Horsey Gap. Horsey is known for its grey seal colony. More than 3,500 seal pups were born between Horsey and Winterton during the 2025 and 2026 season. People love flocking to the beach between November and February to watch them from a safe distance and enjoy a stroll along the dunes. 5. Riding the snails at Great Yarmouth. Many locals have fond memories of riding the snails at Joyland in Great Yarmouth as a child. There is nothing like trundling along the raised tract in one of the brightly coloured carriages. The ride offers something for everyone, being gentle enough for younger children and nostalgic for adults. 6. Having a picnic on Beeston Bump. This 63-metre-high hill of sand, gravel and boulders sits on the North Norfolk coast just east of Sheringham. Those who walk to the top are met with views of Sheringham, the surrounding countryside and the North Sea, plus the remains of a Second World War listening station. The extensive views make it a great spot for scenic picnic during the summer. 7. Fish and chips on Cromer Pier. Locals in Cromer still see having fish and chips on the pier as one of life's simple pleasures. With their food wrapped in paper against the sea breeze, they perch on the benches or lean on the railings, watching the waves roll under their feet. It's a year-round ritual, just as likely on a blustery winter afternoon as on a bright summer evening.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our listener liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. If you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker to listen using the Talking Newspaper skill. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk. But please, when returning the pouch and memory stick, remember to reverse the label. The sound engineer this week was Richard Preston, and the editor was David Audley. Colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a week to remember. And we look forward to joining you again next Friday. But for now, though, from today's readers, it's
cheerio!